At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at Putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Federal Reserve announced today it's going to keep on plowing money into a gummed-up financial system. The Fed's run by economists, of course, so nothing it does is easy to unravel. But here's one interpretation. A year or so into it, the credit crunch is still alive and well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, July the 30th. Glad you could be with us. You know, the Fed being the Fed, it doesn't call its cash infusions into the U.S. banking system cash. Instead, it uses words like primary dealer credit facility and discount window. But cash by any other name is still a whole lot of money, and the Fed said today it's going to extend its emergency loan program for pretty much any bank that needs cash into 2009. Kerry Leahy is an economist with Decision Economics in New York City. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Why did the Fed make the decision today to extend this credit window?
Well, essentially, the Fed has taken on a number of emergency actions that are wide-ranging in scope and large in size, and they decided to continue those actions, even though they may not have the full authority from Congress and the administration to continue that. They decided the best thing to do is to keep these operations running because, in some sense, the financial markets still need the life support from the Fed, as evidenced by the problems we had with the housing agencies, Fannie and Freddie, just a couple of weeks ago.
Does it imply a certain fragility of the financial system that maybe we're not fully appreciating?
Absolutely. The system, which has prided itself on innovation and the ability to obviously create money for a wide variety of people, has basically gotten stuck, clogged up, and is suffering under severe stress. While the economy as a whole may not be in a recession, Wall Street is certainly in a recession, if not a depression, given the conditions of the last year and a half, which echo those of 75 years ago.
So the Fed's been lending money for better than a year now, trying to get the credit crisis unstuck. It's tried to get banks confident enough so that they can then lend to each other and let the Fed get out of this mess. Is there any indication that that's happening, that the banks are doing what they're supposed to do?
I think there is. What we analysts look at are these so-called spreads between various financial assets.
You mean spreads and interest rates, right?
Spreads and interest rates, excuse me. These interest rate spreads have narrowed somewhat. They are wide by historical standards, but you always have the problem when you're looking at these issues that if the Fed had done nothing, things would even be worse. So the fact that the system, which really just broke down, is sort of crawling right now on Wall Street, is actually progress.
The Fed, it seems to me, as a result of these actions, and the Treasury Department now after the housing bill that the president signed today, have their fingers in a lot of pieces of the free market pie. You worried about that?
Oh, absolutely. I think the ultimate risk is potentially a temporary, I hope, a nationalization of the U.S. Housing industry and much more significant regulatory oversight of financial institutions in general over the next 2 to 5 years. I think no matter who's president a year from now, there's a belief that somebody has to pay, and Wall Street's going to have to pay in the form of much more, or what I hope is much more stringent oversight, because Wall Street has failed in the last couple of years.
Kerry Leahy at Decision Economics in New York. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
There's more information today about exactly how small General Motors is going to get as it tries to shave billions in costs. GM said reports the company will cut about 15% of its white-collar workforce are generally accurate. If you've got a hankering for a good old American-built truck or SUV, you better plan on buying one, because the big three are scaling way back on leases, leases that used to make them a whole bunch of money. High gas prices and the tight credit market have flipped the economics of auto leasing upside down, as Marketplace's Dan Gratch reports.
Thanks to leasing, millions of Americans are driving newer, more expensive vehicles than they could afford to buy. Automakers have benefited, too. Leases help move new trucks and SUVs, which are more profitable than smaller cars. Among the big three, one in five new vehicles is leased. That era is ending. Ford and GM this week are scaling back leases. Chrysler has ended them altogether. The reason? Expensive gas has destroyed the resale value of gas guzzlers. Brendan Moore runs the website autosavant.net.
So that Cadillac Escalade is not worth 50% when it's coming off lease. It's worth more like, say, 26%. Big, big problem. You extrapolate this across several million vehicles, and you're looking at billions of dollars of losses.
Before $4 a gallon gas, trucks and SUVs were one of the few bright spots for U.S. automakers. But John Blair with Automotive Lease Guides says big cars' days may be numbered, leases are not.
Would you be willing to pay $300 or $400 a month more to have that luxury? You know, I think it's a pretty easy decision for most consumers. I think they're going to say, you know what, I'll figure out a way to get my skis to the mountain in some other fashion.
Chrysler hopes to hang on to its old leasing customers with a new math. It plans to offer 72-month loans for new vehicles. The monthly payments will be about the same as those on a 3-year lease. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Oil shook off the slide it's been on the past couple of weeks. Crude shot up more than $4.50 today to almost $127 a barrel. If you think that's making it tough on you at the pumps, pity truckers who've got to fill up those huge gas tanks on their semis. Today, though, the trucking business offered a rest stop on the highway of gloomy economic news. An industry group said truckers moved more cargo this June than they did a year ago. It's the eighth straight month of increases. But Marketplace's Amy Scott reports we're going to have to wait for the rest of the economy to catch up.
If manufacturers and retailers are shipping more stuff, that suggests demand for that stuff is picking up. Tavio Headley is an economist with the American Trucking Associations, or ATA. He says the total tonnage of goods shipped by truck last month rose by more than 5% compared to June of last year. But he's not ready to celebrate just yet.
The first half of last year was really weak, so it doesn't really take much to show year earlier improvement. So all in all, the year-over-year increases, they're a very positive sign for our industry, but it's still too early to call it a full recovery.
You don't have to tell truck driver Jason Perkins. I caught him on his mobile phone outside Atlanta. He was on his way to pick up a load of insulation bound for New Jersey.
I have not seen tonnage going up. What I've seen is a lot of our competition has gone belly up.
Close to 1,000 trucking companies filed for bankruptcy in the first 3 months of the year. Analysts say the second quarter was probably even worse. Perkins says one big reason, the price of diesel.
When we pull into a truck stop and fuel up, we could very easily spend $1,000 just to fill up our tanks. So fueling up every other day, I mean, that's a big strain on anyone's pocketbook.
If trucking demand continues to rebound, it may be a while before the broader economy follows suit. The ATA says in the 2001 downturn, demand recovered before the overall economy even fell into recession. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Oil rose today, as I mentioned. So did the markets. Somehow we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Iraqi parliament recessed for the summer today. They did it without resolving key disagreements about a set of provincial elections scheduled to be held this fall. The recess also stalls negotiations over a supplemental budget. So far, the United States has budgeted almost $118 billion for rebuilding Iraq. But a new report out today suggests that's just about enough. Stuart Bones, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Mr. Bowen, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's good to be with you again.
If I read this report right, sir, you don't think the Iraqis necessarily need more American money to finish their reconstruction?
Well, it's not just what I think, it's what they say. A couple of months ago in Brussels, Prime Minister Maliki said exactly that, that Iraq didn't need more funds, it needed technical assistance. And last week, Barham Saleh echoed those words when he said that financial assistance is not the chief need for the country, but building their capacity to govern is.
Barham Saleh, of course, the deputy prime minister who's in charge of reconstruction, right?
That's correct.
What then is the problem? Do they just not know how to spend the money they have?
That is one of the most significant problems. Budget execution is what it's called, a term of art meaning how well can the Iraqis spend the enormous resources that they are taking in this year? And the answer is not very well. It was a significant problem in 2006. Under a quarter of their budget that year was spent. Last year, over half of it was spent. But this year, certainly at the provincial level, the early numbers are not very good. For the country to make progress, it needs to spend its money well, and it needs to do it fairly expeditiously, and certainly instead of spending U.S. taxpayer money.
How do you teach somebody, though, how to spend money?
That's a fair question. It's about understanding the new contracting regulations that the Iraqi government has chosen to adopt, the process for soliciting bids, the award process, and then ultimately how then the money is dispensed to the contractor and the work is carried out. That's sort of the soup to nuts on getting a project done. It's much more complicated than what I just described, though.
Your report's been in the public domain for a day or so now. Have you started getting calls from members of Congress yet asking why we're still funding Iraqi reconstruction?
I actually just came from the Hill in a meeting with Congressman Chandler from Kentucky asking me exactly that question, rhetorically, I might add, because he and his fellow members of Congress make those kinds of decisions. I think it's notable that the latest supplemental was less than half of the previous one. So less U.S. money is being spent, fewer dollars are being appropriated, and it's going towards targeted capacity building and operations and maintenance programs.
What does that mean, targeted capacity building?
That's a good question. Capacity building means teaching the Iraqis how to spend their money, teaching the Iraqis how to carry out governance programs. That means develop a plan to expand the electrical grid, to implement their oil law, if they ever get it passed, and to develop an army and a police that can enforce the rule of law.
Stuart Bowen is the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Mr. Bowen, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
If you've got a stack of books yet to be read piling up on your nightstand, then it's a good thing summer's here because this is a great time to work through that stack. The bad news, though, is that we're about to add to it. Our summer series, Marketplace Beach Reads, is back this week with nominations from some of our regular commentators. Today's title comes to us from the Gilded Age. Marketplace commentator Robert Reich says more than a century later, its themes still resonate.
Ordinarily, I'd never recommend you take a book by an economist to the beach. I wouldn't even recommend you take an economist to the beach. The exception is Thorstein Veblen, and his book is The Theory of the Leisure Class. Veblen wrote this classic in 1899, near the end of the Gilded Age, when robber barons ran wild. But the book is just as fresh and relevant today. In Veblen's view, the reason people seek great wealth has more to do with social status than purchasing power. One way wealthy people show their superiority is through what he called conspicuous leisure, signaling they have so much wealth they don't even have to break a sweat. When Veblen was writing, the rich had private railroad carriages to take them wherever and whenever they wanted, just as today's financial and corporate barons have their private jets. Veblen likened the very rich to the ancient Polynesian chiefs, who under the stress of good form preferred to starve than carry their food to their mouths with their own hands. The other way the rich show their superiority is through what Veblen called conspicuous consumption. In order to establish their place in the pecking order of the wealthy, the very rich want the not-so-very rich to witness their power to consume. So in the Gilded Age, they built giant estates, gave lavish parties, bought newfangled horseless carriages, and dined at the fanciest and most expensive restaurants. Sound familiar? Economics normally assumes that the demand for goods and services drops as their prices increase. But Veblen noted that among the very rich, it's often the opposite. Demand is highest for the highest-priced goods, not because they're necessarily better, but because their high prices offer status for people who can afford them. Now, what to do about the vast concentration of wealth and income that characterized the Gilded Age? Veblen was skeptical that government would do much. Just as they controlled big corporations and Wall Street, the wealthy also controlled government. In his words, representative government means chiefly representation of business interests. The year was 1899, but it might have been 2008. We're in America's second Gilded Age. So take Veblen to the beach and learn more about it. But don't expect him to give you much social status. He's in paperback, and he's cheap.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. We have asked for and gotten recommendations from some of you since we're exploring the Gilded Age today. How about the appropriately titled satire, The Gilded Age, by Mark Twain and Charles Dudley Warner? That came to us from Dan Faraday of Rockledge, Florida. If you've got a title for us, marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says Best Marketplace Beach Reads. Coming up, driving through in a down economy.
There's not this huge quality gap between fast food and casual dining anymore. You can get, you know, sirloin, Angus burgers, prime rib burgers. I mean, you name it, you can get it at fast food now.
But first, let's do the numbers. Hey, so here's a new one. Oil spikes up and the markets hold their own. The Dow Industrials climbed 1.6% today, 186 points. Closed at 11,583. The NASDAQ nudged up 0.4%, 10 points to finish at 2329. The S&P 500 moved up 1.4%, 17 points, ended the day at 1280. Takeoff meet landing after a sky-high session yesterday. Airline stocks hit some turbulence today. Delta and Northwest each nosedived around 9%. AMR and UAL, that's American and United, dipped about 7% apiece. Investors reamed OfficeMax for a lousy second quarter. Its shares lost more than 10% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.05%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the Advanced Gross Domestic Product Report for the second quarter. A House committee looks at the growing income gap in the middle class. And the Senate Special Committee on Aging holds a hearing on access to health care for seniors in rural areas of the country. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the most closely watched box scores in baseball these days is who's in the running to buy the Chicago Cubs from Sam Zell and the Tribune Company. Today, billionaire Mark Cuban, who already owns basketball's Dallas Mavericks, got an unexpected endorsement. NBA Commissioner David Stern said baseball owners should welcome Cuban into their club. When you go see a major league game, you know you're going to be tied up for the next 2.5 or 3 hours easy. You'd be lucky to get out of a full game of cricket without taking a week-long vacation. International matches in that sport can take 5 days. Yes, they break for breakfast and lunch, even tea. But this year, a new league has turned the old-school cricket business on its head. Mehul Srivastava has the story from New Delhi.
How do you take a game that's normally slow and boring and get it ready for prime time? The brand new Indian Premier League has an idea. Limit the number of pitches so that every swing counts.
That's huge! That is a piggy! It's out of here!
It's called 2020 Cricket, and it squeezes 5 days of cricket into 3 action-packed hours. The Indian Premier League made big changes off the field, too. Rock music blasting through stadium speakers, Bollywood film stars as team owners, and cheerleaders imported from the Washington Redskins to liven up the crowds. But even traditionalists are warming up to the idea. Arun Lal is a former cricketer turned sportscaster.
Well, it's primarily cricket. I mean, certainly compressed. It's just cricket which is happening very, very fast.
Here in New Delhi, police officers are guiding a crowd of 55,000 people into an overflowing stadium. It's a big game, with the Delhi Daredevils battling the Mumbai Indians for a chance to play in the finals. The surprising popularity of this new style of cricket means there's plenty of money to be made. Corporate sponsors have invested $1 billion to bring in high-powered lineups of international cricket stars. And Sony paid $1 billion for domestic broadcast rights. Yogesh Shetty is CEO of a company that just shelled out $84 million for the Delhi Daredevils. He's got a financial model in mind, American sports.
I think the Americans would love this. It's action-packed. Within 3 hours, the game is over. I think the commercialization has come from America. The marketing has come from America. It's more like baseball now.
Except baseball has never drawn these kind of numbers. Last year's World Series averaged 17 million television viewers per game. Over 140 million people watched the Delhi Daredevils beat the Mumbai Indians. The biggest surprise? Almost half the TV audience was female. Rajashree Sen would never come to a five-day test match. But for this game, she snuck out of work early.
The games are shorter, so a lot of people can come in with their families, so they can bring their wives in and their girlfriends. I think the female audience will be more interested.
And all this, the billions of dollars and millions of fans, is just the beginning. Cricket-crazy countries like Australia, Pakistan, and England are planning similar leagues of their own. Someday, the creators of the Premier League hope they might even convince Americans to pay attention. In New Delhi, I'm Mehul Srivastava for Marketplace.
The television at my house is on the fritz, so we've all been gathering around the laptop to catch our favorite shows online. It's nice to cuddle together and all, but Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the number of viewers making a habit of watching on the web is giving executives in TV land an enormous headache.
Up to 20% of TV viewers are no longer watching TV. Instead, they're streaming their favorite shows on the net, according to a new survey by Integrated Media Measurement. Brad Adgate is with media buyer Horizon Media.
Well, of course, the pitfalls is what does that do to the ratings on the television show?
And advertising dollars. That's a conundrum for network executives and shows like Gossip Girl.
The CW Network's hottest new series.
Gossip Girl did so well online, network executives worried it was cannibalizing the TV audience. So they pulled it off the net. But Amanda Welsh at Integrated Media Measurement says that's a bad idea. Online viewers tend to be busy.
Being able to decide when and where they watch TV is critical for them.
They also tend to be women.
Well-educated, high-income women of a certain age are very attractive to advertisers because we know that they drive a lot of purchasing decisions.
Welsh says when a network streams programs on the web, more often than not, it ends up building its broadcast audience. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
We'll get the official number Friday, but today the data services company ADP gave us a sneak peek at the state of the labor market. It says the private sector added 9,000 new jobs last month. ADP is the company that processes paychecks for a lot of companies out there, so you'd think they'd have an inside track. Sometimes their numbers match up with the Labor Department, sometimes not. So sometimes it pays to go looking for other ways to figure out what the economy's doing. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson is on the line with the latest in our series of unusual economic indicators. Jeremy?
Well, this, Kai, is one of the stories that any marketplace employee would just kill for. It is something you can taste. The economic indicator is the burger indicator. Fast food sales, it turns out, go up when the economy goes down. Now, I went up to Northeast Maryland to a brand new Burger King just off I-95. I met up with restaurant industry analyst Steve West of Stiefel Nicholas.
Welcome to Burger King. Can I help you?
I will have the number one meal, the Whopper meal.
Whopper meal. Would you like cheese on that?
Cheese would be great.
All right, I'm going to take the BK Stacker value meal.
For here to go.
For here? And I'll take that with the onion rings and a Coke, please.
12.06.
Now, we are in a Burger King that is very different than any Burger King that I've ever seen. These lamps, I mean, they're little halogen lamps that you might see in an Applebee's, but it doesn't look like a Burger King.
Right, and that's the trend that you're seeing throughout the entire fast food industry, kind of really led by McDonald's. You're seeing entire fast food industry go to these nicer, newer looking stores, either remodeling or just tearing down the old building and building a new one right in its place. There's not this huge quality gap between fast food and casual dining anymore. You can get, you know, sirloin, Angus burgers, prime rib burgers. I mean, you name it, you can get it at fast food now.
It's like a steakhouse in here.
It is. And so probably 5 years ago, if you admitted to somebody you went to McDonald's or Burger King to eat, you'd probably be embarrassed, or you wouldn't admit it because it was so bad. Now it's not the same anymore.
Is that because the people that went to Applebee's, the people that went to Chili's and TGI Fridays, because of tight economic times, are having to go to restaurants that they may not have, a Burger King or McDonald's, and they want them to be nicer?
Yes, people are still eating out, but we're eating out of fast food now because it's cheaper. It's about a third the price of casual dining. So you see the casual dining restaurants like Applebee's, Chili's, even Cheesecake Factory, these guys are really losing a lot of sales, a lot of traffic, as consumers are tightening their belts and trading down instead of trading out of eating out.
Okay, well, before we go any further, take a bite of your stacker and tell me how it is.
Okay. Excellent as usual.
If we're heading into a recession now and seeing sales tick up at these fast food restaurants, do they go down when times are good?
That's a good question, and time will tell. But I would say, you know, looking out ahead, when the consumer does rebound, we got to believe they will at some point. I would think that fast food would stand to lose a little more than casual. Casual will definitely stand to gain.
Now, of course, it's fast food that's gaining right now. U.S. sales at McDonald's are up, in large part thanks to an increase in traffic. Same story with Burger King, Taco Bell, and Hardee's. And Steve West says he expects the same trend, fast food up, casual dining down, to continue for at least another year, Kai.
All right, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson in Washington. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we go today. You know, it's always smart to stay out of the sun and protect your skin. And if you do have to go out, please be sure to use plenty of sunscreen. Farmers here in California are taking that message to heart. For themselves, maybe, but for their fruit and produce, definitely. The Associated Press ran a story today about sunscreen that's made specifically for crops. It's SPF 45, apparently washes off at home before you eat whatever you brought home. And here's the marketplace angle, because I can hear you asking out there. Crops without sunspots or skin blisters sell for higher prices. Nuts that have been sunscreened get 3 cents a pound more. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 186 points, 1.6%. The NASDAQ hiked up 10 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 gained 17 points, 1.4% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, heating oil burns through budgets.
I've always had like a $200 a month buffer in my budget, so that's what I'm going to have to use to pay for my fuel. And it's not going to cover it either.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.